Empire of the Suns.
Suns.
Empire of the Suns.
Wet like on book. Wet like on book. Wet like on book.
Arizona Sports presents the Empire of the Suns podcast.
Empire of the Suns.
Hello there and welcome to the Empire of the Suns podcast. My name is Kellen Olson. I'm a reporter, writer, editor for ArizonaSports.com. I am all aboard the Struggle Bus USA today. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Kevin Zerman. Kevin, how are you handling the post-holiday time? I am hanging on by a thread.
After Christmas was rough, because Christmas is just a long day, and now I did the sleep-in thing today because I didn't work in the morning, which is very nice. Thanks, boss man.
Yeah, we flipped scripts there. I mean, I didn't come in early like you're doing those 6 a.m. wake ups, which are just ridiculous. I would never be able to pull it off like you can, Mr. Zerman. But
I try.
I'm gonna try and make it along as I can. My cough is never gonna leave ever. Okay, so since we last podcasted, the Suns have gone 1-2, but it's a deceptive 1-2. They lost in a 3-overtime thriller in Washington. Kind of a schedule loss the next day against Brooklyn. They were in the game in the mid-third quarter, and then the legs came down as they should. And then they beat the Orlando Magic in overtime on Wednesday, which was yesterday, recording this Thursday afternoon. I think this three-game stretch was kind of misleading a bit, because I think the Suns did some really bad things in these games. Most notably the Washington game, defensively they were not very good. I thought in the Orlando game they actually weren't that good defensively, and then Brooklyn, I saw some of that as well. But I guess the most encouraging part of that is that they were able to get a win out of it, and arguably should have had a second win in the Washington game. So it depends on how you look at it. I guess I look at it as they were able to win ugly.
Everyone was really excited about the 3-overtime Washington game, and I've said this like twice on this podcast this year, where you watch it and I'm yelling at the TV like, what are you doing? Like, the entire game was almost unwatchable from both team standpoints. They should have, I don't care how bad the Suns are, they should have beaten that Washington team. Washington is a mess. So that one was the worst one for me. Like, Brooklyn, again, bad defense, but Brooklyn's a better team, so that went how it should. Magic was a little bit more of bad play by the Suns, but I'll say that was, I think, their best game. As far as just all around, they got enough stops, they made enough plays. Obviously, they won, so maybe that's why I'm thinking that, but I think that was their best game. So it was good that after the, again, very awful Washington game, they've kind of refound what had made them win 4 in a row before that.
That's a good way of putting it for the Orlando game in terms of just making enough plays, because end of the first quarter, they're down 32-20. The offense was terrible, but then it's just a little 6-0 run at the end of the quarter, and all of a sudden a very bad first quarter is transformed into a, okay, we'll manage, we're lucky we're only down 6, and then they come out on a huge run. The biggest takeaway from this whole run of 5 of 7 has to be the play of the bench. We are used to seeing Devin Booker come out, and then leads just disintegrate in our eyes, like someone in purple skin snaps their fingers and it's just gone. Shit. That's a Avengers reference for you kiddos at home.
I didn't get it, to be honest.
You didn't see Infinity War?
I'm very uncultured right now. I just watched Black Panther, so
okay, so Infinity Wars
a few years
Infinity
behind.
Wars on Netflix now.
Mm.
Came out on Christmas, so
yeah.
Get yourself cultured.
I did see that, and I said I should watch that, because I did watch, yeah. Dude, I'm catching
just picture
up.
You
fine.
Scrolling through Netflix at 2 a.m. being like, oh, I'm going to watch that when it's not 2 a.m. and I have to go to sleep.
Yeah, yeah, it'll happen sometime.
We're going to talk about it. We're going to have a 40-minute podcast on Infinity War. So that's how Leeds used to go when Devin Booker would exit the game. But now, with the amount of energy that they play with and Kelly Oubre all of a sudden being just that extra push over the edge in terms of another playmaker, and now the Trevor Ariza role of the starter who kind of spends time with the reserves a bit has gone from Ariza to Bridges, and so now you've got the Bridges-Jackson Oubre trio, which is at its apex terrific defensively. Yeah. Not even good or great. It's absolutely terrific. So when you play those guys with Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton, I'm going to be curious to watch the lineup data for that over the next month or so. But those three guys playing defense, energy, and shooting a little bit. Bridges obviously gives you some, but he's not even shooting the ball that well this year. And then Oubre and Jackson, who knows on their jumpers. But all you need for the offense to work is to have Booker and Ayton running pick and roll together. And then you've got their defense and energy plays. But back to the bench play, it doesn't really matter even who's the point guard there. Like, Elie Okobo was just kind of finding himself in rhythm in that Orlando game a little bit just because he didn't really have to do that much.
I think the first half of the Magic game where that bench, you just mentioned the run, where Josh Jackson was making the right reads, passing. But we've talked about this the last few podcasts, but Oubre is rubbing off on, like, Josh Jackson. Their defensive, just that unit with Rashawn Holmes, and we should probably talk about him more because I legitimately saw at least three plays last night where a Magic player was driving and should have taken a shot, but just didn't, like, you could see it, like, split-second hesitation because they thought Rashawn would either come over or he did come over. And people are just super conscious of what he's doing and the problems he causes. Another play, he switched onto a guard and was just, you know, he's able to do that, which people talked about Ayton doing that. And he's been, well, 19 minutes he played last night. He was plus 12. Two blocks, 8 points, four rebounds. So just stealing minutes from the starters, I think, is the biggest thing. And playing with a lot of energy in that bench unit. Look, a lot of them aren't going to play down the stretch because, look, Mikal, Book, Warren, Bridges, like I said, Bridges and Mikal. But Oubre in there is going to play down the stretch when they finally go point Book, but they're stealing minutes is what I'm getting at. And whether that's Melton and Okobo keeping Book away from the point guard spot and letting him do that just in the fourth quarter in overtime where he has his legs and is going to make shots. That last night was also huge where he has the legs and he's able to go one-on-one and just break down defenses where in the past you would see that he's just forced to chuck up tough jumpers because he just is tired and he's been playing defense the whole game. So I think it's just a really good mix that they've found right now, and the Kobo addition is going to be interesting to watch just in this next stretch here.
Yeah, to see how he handles it. The most encouraging thing for me from that, and I know I said like the bench play has to be it, but I think for me it's just the play of the offense. They're sixth in offensive rating over the six-game stretch when compared to the rest of the league. I said it's they've won 5 of 7, but I looked at the last six games in particular. They're at 113.3 for their offensive rating, which is great. But when you look at the player stats, is Booker averaging 31 a game, Warren's at 21, Ayton's at 20, and Oubre's at 15. And the thing about that is Ayton is the only guy shooting above 50% amongst that group. So over a 5 or 6 game sample size, you're assuming if the numbers are way up that they're just shooting efficiently to a crazy regard or something. And it's really not even that. Josh Jackson shooting 42%. Same thing with Mikal Bridges. Jamal Crawford's at 30. De'Anthony Melton's at 42. So the efficiency isn't sky high right now in terms of their conversions on shots, but they're still managing to have a top 10 offense in the league over this stretch because of that extra addition that Oubre brings in offense. I think that's maybe something we're underrating about him a bit, is that he can come in and average 12 to 14 points a game over this stretch, and that just gives you a little bit more of a boost of bench offense that you didn't quite have before. We haven't even mentioned it yet. We should also say that Devin Booker appears to be healthy.
Yeah.
And this is what we have been, I think, kind of to a frustrating degree, we've been kind of waiting for to talk about on the podcast, because we were expecting him to have a really big year this year and kind of take the So I wrote the thing last year that I believed he was one of the 12 best players in the conference and he should have made the All-Star team. That was my case. I thought he was going to have that type of season this year where he actually gained some buzz in that regard. I didn't expect the assist to be so high because I didn't expect him to be playing alongside D'Anthony or starting alongside someone like D'Anthony Melton or Isaiah Kanan or whatever and a real point guard, but can't win them all there. But he's been playing really, really well since he came back, averaging 30 points, 5 rebounds, and 8 assists a game while shooting efficiently from the field. The three ball might be back. He's shooting 36% from three on 7.5 attempts a game since coming back. And once again, he told the media this is the first time he had been fully healthy all year. And he's sort of having that star-making season where I think in most people's eyes here locally, he's already a star. But on a national level, I think he's going to have a stretch here if he stays healthy over the last 45, 50 games of the year, where he kind of has his welcome to that level of stardom kind of moment. And this is like the very beginning of it where he should be taking over games more frequently. He didn't do so in the Washington game, but he did so in Orlando. Do you think that, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, how would you say he has balanced everything so far? And by everything, I mean he's clearly trying much harder on defense, and he's also playing two positions at once, being the point guard. Because I think he's starting to get just to a manageable level. I'm not saying he can be way better than this, but I still think that he's still figuring out the balancing act.
I think he's... I'll phrase it like this. I'll put him at like a 6 out of 10.
Yeah.
Because I think he has a lot to learn, and from a level that we probably can't even perceive or understand from watching and not being pro athletes or point guards. But I think he's actually managed it well in that he's trying new things. Like the assist numbers, we need to give him credit for that because there's no part of his game that has improved more than that. And that's just from last year. And he was, like you said, he was all-star level, arguably, last year. So he's looked completely like a new player. I think a lot of where he needs to grow is if he wants to be James Harden level down the stretch, like when he is point book, because there were times in that Washington game where he was just getting tunnel vision a bit, and he was the point guard, and I can't say he missed plays, but he was forcing plays to score himself. And
oh yeah, he's 22 years old kind of moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's just that alpha guy, and I think Igor has spoken about this after games this road trip, where it's just like, we put so much on him, but they're not going to complain about him taking too many shots. Like, the fact that in the middle of games, he's really learned how to manipulate defenses to open up his teammates. He's come such a long way in that regard. Like, it'll come at the end of games, but they don't want to take away his aggression as well. So, and last night it paid off against the Magic. Like, he hit some huge shots. He had one of those, I think there was that sequence where I think Fournier hit a three. He comes back, hits a three, then gets a steal and dunks it. One, that's his legs are there to do all those things in a little sequence. And two, he's accepting, like, and that stuff about rubbing off and playing with a little aggression on defense to get that steal was impressive down the stretch.
One of the things we've talked about with him in terms of projecting his growth going forward is how do we look at him as a top 25 to 50 player, wherever you put him on the spectrum, and him potentially being a top 10 or 15 player in the league at one point. The gap between those is a lot higher than it sounds, or a lot wider than it sounds, I should say. It's not as simple as being better than 15 more guys. It's a certain level of stardom and just reading the floor and handling situations. And I mention that because the Orlando game, they're up 3. And they foul with a foul to give. There's 4.5 seconds left. They foul to give, 2.5 seconds left. The logical thing to do there was for the Suns to take their final timeout, but Orlando did not have a timeout. So Igor Kokoshkov, in my mind, what he was thinking was they don't have time to draw up a play. They're just going to call some set thing here. We should be fine defensively. Just obviously don't foul. Mikal Bridges gets the bogus foul call on him, and then the broadcast picks up that Devin Booker was furious with the coaching staff. He went over to Joe Prunty and talked to him first, and then was just yelling on the bench at himself, to himself, that they should have called a timeout and they should have talked about fouling, because you're up three, free throws, 2 seconds left, 1 second left, whatever. I would actually argue that it's really tough to foul in that situation. I think it was heat of the moment, because 2.5 seconds left on the catch, guy's making maybe one basketball move where you can foul, and even then, if you grab him, I think he's going to shoot it.
Yeah.
So I'm not even
sure. Yeah.
But I bring that up because Booker was still visibly frustrated for the next 2 or 3 minutes of in-game time. For the first 2-3 minutes of overtime, he still looked like he was pissed off about it. And it was clearly affecting his play, because what happened at the end of the fourth quarter, in the last 6 minutes, everyone was scoring, and then nobody scored in overtime. But everyone was scoring, and the Suns were scoring by putting Nikola Vucevic in a ball screen every single time, because Orlando went from not playing Booker so aggressively in pick and roll to playing him super aggressive, and Vucevic has zero idea how to do that effectively. He's just too slow and too bad at it. So they kept going at him, and then they just stopped going at him, or at least Booker did, and then TJ Warren started going at him, and that's just a different story. Booker's giving the ball off to him, which is fine and everything, but at the same time, that's just like, okay, that happened, we screwed up, whatever, let's go at Vucevic again. And he wasn't doing that, and I found that odd in the moment, but I think it was just because he was frustrated, and that's another type of situation where you move on from that and go on. It was a much, much, much less significant JR, why didn't you figure out how much time was left kind of moment, where like LeBron's going to freak out for 15 seconds and then he's just got to spend the whole time on the bench like getting locked in as much as he can. And it's one of those moments where he had to kind of have his time to be frustrated but then get locked back in, because they could have lost that game. No one was able to score.
Yeah.
But they could have easily lost that game in overtime. DeAndre Ayton played some great defense, of course. But at the same time, if Orlando would have just executed on offense, they would have won that game. And it would have been because Booker was, in my mind, his frustration led to him not playing that well in the overtime.
I like what we see, though, from him, because he's, even compared to last year, he's just really taken on the I'm going to yell at my teammates role. And I think he's good about, like, he'll get on Ayton, and then he'll give him a high five the next time down if he does something good. Like, he's not, I don't think he's overbearing from what I can tell, but he's grown a lot as a guy who wants to be a coach on the floor. And I think that's also helping TJ be accountable on defense. It's helping Ayton roll to the rim harder the next time if he's just floating for a few seconds.
TJ's kind of feeling himself lately. He's low-key forcing things. I've never seen him force things before more than once in a game. In the Orlando game, he forced like a couple of shots, and I was like, look at TJ getting some, not getting some confidence, but just being like, I'm the guy to score the basketball right now, and I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
Which is a plus and a negative playing next to Booker, but I think that's something worth noting to watch on the homestand.
It's just, chemistry.
Where he goes in his spots, because he's still figuring out. He's clearly much better this year. The stats, people are mentioning why when he win most improved, and it's because if you look at his stats directly next to each other, he's actually been worse this year, technically, except the three-point shooting. But you see him, and it's like he can handle the ball more, he can attack more, he can obviously shoot now way more, and it seems like he's picking his spots better, too. And that version of him now has to not duel with Booker, but trade spots with Booker and Ayton more. A couple of times last night where I was like, dude, Ayton's right there for the post entry. Just feed him the ball.
Yeah, so he's not going to do that.
I just wanted, exactly. I wanted to mention that as something to kind of watch, because it's something that's caught my eyes, him actually forcing things a little bit. And seeing him in those positions is interesting, because we've never seen him there. Sorry, what were you talking about?
I don't remember.
Okay.
But I was going to go off that where I actually have liked what Igor has done, or it seems like Igor is doing it, where I think earlier in their winning streak, Book would have big games, or actually, well, it was later in that 4-game win streak, but Book would have big games in the first half, and then they would come out in the third quarter and just completely catch teams off guard, because they would just start feeding TJ, and teams were spending probably halftime like, okay, here's how we have to adjust for Booker, and then the Suns would just throw something else at them that they hadn't planned for. And that's where managing where TJ gets his touches around Booker always being the guy is going to be, you know, it's worked lately. And I don't know if that's him just getting loose more or if it's Igor finding the moments to target him.
Let's discuss the homestand just a bit and kind of preview it before we move on to other things. 7-game homestand. They are a lot of good teams, and that's the main difference here, is that the Suns won 5 of 7. But if you look at these teams for what they are, Dallas and Minnesota are probably not going to be playoff teams in the West. They're in the bottom half of the West, which isn't saying much because it's so clustered right now. New York, one of the worst teams in the league. Orlando, one of the worst teams in the league. And then Boston, that was just legitimately, I don't care how bad the Celtics were playing, that was legitimately a pretty good win. But other than that, Washington, of course, you mentioned is a train wreck. Brooklyn without Caris LeVert is one of the worst teams in the league. And this is not me saying what they did didn't matter or anything. I'm just saying this is now really the proving grounds, because you've got Oklahoma City on Friday, and then the day after you got Denver, Golden State, Philly, the Clippers, Charlotte, and Sacramento. All 7 of those teams are playoff teams right now. So when you look at it from that lens, I want to see the more questionable parts of this recent surge. I'm willing to, I really want to see how the bench, is the bench able to keep up what's been going, what happens to them when they give up a 13-2 run?
Yeah.
Does the energy die off? How does the substitution pattern change? Is Igor, now that everyone is fully healthy, is he going to start staggering Warren and Booker? Is he going to do more of what he's kind of done with Ayton, and that, like, bringing him out 6 minutes in and letting him play with the reserves a bit to get more offense in there? How does Josh Jackson kind of equate into the whole thing with Kelly Oubre's emergence? What are one or two things you're looking at from how they've improved in the past 7 or 8 games that you're really eager to see against top level competition, because that's what they're going to be facing?
It starts against the Thunder, because what are they? I didn't look this up. They're probably the best defensive team in the NBA.
They've got to be like top three.
They've
right
got
now.
To be.
Yeah.
So I just want to see if that offense keeps churning. And we've praised, they've been in games because their defense, as much as they're giving up shots, points, and stretches, they do have, like we talked about this, the deflections, and they've been able to disrupt teams just enough where they can hang and just enough where they can go on a run. Oklahoma City is pretty much going to be it, where you're going to have to somehow get Russell Westbrook and Paul George, who might be having his best season. I don't know.
It's there. If you've been not so, it's one of those things where we'll jump up and be like, holy crap, Paul George having a great year. Who knew?
Yeah.
He's been terrific this year. Oklahoma City is first in defensive rating this year.
I just want to see them compete with them, Denver, Golden State. Even if, you know, if it's a second quarter and they get blown out, do they look better for their other three quarters? Stuff like that, where things don't snowball on them and they can kind of respond. I don't expect them to be able to win any of those three games, but look, if the other team comes out flat, they hit Scottsdale the night before, like, any win against those teams is a good win. Competing against those teams is a win in my book for this team.
Quick quiz for you and the people at home. So the 7 teams: Oklahoma City, Denver, Golden State, Philadelphia, the Clippers, Charlotte, and Sacramento. 5 of those 7 teams are top 10 in offensive or defensive rating. What are the 2 teams that are not?
Charlotte.
Nope. Charlotte is top 10 in offensive rating this year. Kemba. Kemba's been unreal this year.
Whoa.
They are 8th in offensive rating, 110.
Sacramento?
Sacramento is not in the top 10 of either. The other one's tough.
Philly?
Yeah, Philly. Philly is cheating. Philly's 11th in offensive rating. They're 0.1 off of top 10.
Not cheating. That's fact.
And then defensive rating, they are 12th. But that's the caliber we're speaking. Golden State is the best offensive team in the league. Surprise, surprise. Everything's going wrong over there, but they still have the best offense in the league.
Very wrong.
Oklahoma City's the best defense in the league, and then the Clippers have the 4th best offensive rating.
Yeah.
The only team of those to be top 10 in offensive and defensive rating, my Denver Nuggets. my sleeper number two pick in the West.
It's not a sleeper, man.
They're getting... Yeah, that's kind of unfair. They're going through injuries right now. They're a team to watch, especially on the second game of a back-to-back, where you look at it and hope that they can figure something out. Ninth in offensive rating and seventh in defensive rating. I want to see Devin Booker have at least one game here where he scores. Doesn't even have to score a lot. It's just, does he have 28 and 10 on 11 shots and they win the game? Is he able to have one of those games where he's the best player on the court and they win? Because I think he can be the best player on the court and they lose. That's happened a whole lot to him in the past year or so. But that Clipper game is one that sticks out to me. And then Charlotte and Sacramento, I think it's a tough ask for those first four games. That's really brutal, those first four. DeAndre Ayton is someone we've hit on a lot over the course of the season. He's hit on over the course of the season how much he improves in the second matchup with guys. He's already faced Steven Adams twice. This is, I believe, the third time.
Oh, I think Adams was out the first time, but yeah.
Oh, Adams was out the first time? Okay.
Because he got destroyed by...
They played Denver in the second game of the year, right? And Jokic, yeah, Jokic had his fun with him. This will be his second time playing against Jokic. This will be his second time against Embiid. This will be his third time against Boban. So he's getting more experienced or having that second or third go with these guys where he does always improve. And then against Golden State, I guess you can count Kevon Looney or whatever, or JaVale McGee,
I guess,
as a second round. But I'm looking at him too, because he's probably been, if I'm looking at all the players over this 2 weeks, he's been the most improved of everyone. So how does he hold up against this level of competition as well? It's very interesting. We're in late December, and there is serious intrigue as to the games coming up. I think Burns and Gambo today was like, the Suns have an upcoming homestand, and we can't wait for it. We'll tell you next why. And it's like, whoa, we're excited about the 9-26 team. Who knew?
Yeah, it's that back half where, well, half of seven. The last four games are winnable, I'd say.
Yeah.
And that's Philly, Clippers, Hornets, and Kings. They need to pull two of those, I think, for us to keep this optimism up, I would say. And that seems super low, but in the West, those two teams are right there with everyone else. I think Charlotte, you should beat Charlotte if you've made this much improvement for real. But yeah, it's... Those first three, it's whether they take steps backward against good teams.
My disclaimer is they're due for a stinker. They haven't had a stinker in a while, and teams are always due for them, even the good teams, and this is not a good team. So I'd be on the lookout for that. Just be ready for that one game where everything goes wrong.
Could be the first game.
Could be that first game against Oklahoma City with the way that they're playing recently. They're, I believe, like 22-11 now, 21-12. They've really picked it up after a rough start. I'm looking for just be competitive in six of the seven games. I'll take one stinker. That's fine. I don't even care how many they win. They can go 1-6 on these, but as long as they're competitive and in the game in the mid fourth quarter in almost all of them, I think that's acceptable to me.
I'm going to throw Kellen a bone here, and we're going to shift gears, and we're going to talk about the draft, even though we said that we wouldn't do it till New Year's. Happy New Year's, Kellen.
This is the reality of content on ArizonaSports.com in the last like couple days of December, where we await the likely firing of Steve Wilks. It's kind of like trying to get to that date. So we're looking to talk draft at the top of the next new year, but we spoiled ourselves. And I say we, I mean I. I spoiled myself.
Made the executive decision to go ahead and do it, which is cool.
Hey, it's no surprise when you watch this basketball man do the basketball things, but Zion Williamson is the best prospect in this draft. We are referring to my first big board of the NBA draft prospects this year. I do this every year, and me and you kind of carry along the podcasts as they come along with our written posts. The board will evolve over the year. We'll take Suns fit into consideration. We'll talk about how they fit in Phoenix, and we'll add more prospects and on and on and on. So we start with the top 10, but I think the important disclaimer before we talk about Zion is this draft is bad. It's not very good right now. RJ Barrett is far and away the second best prospect in this class, in my opinion. And if you've seen RJ Barrett play by now, you're probably not a huge fan of that assessment. But it's the reality of this class. There's a couple of freshmen There's Langford from Indiana. There's Nasir Little at North Carolina. Quentin Grimes at Kansas. There's this handful of guys, including Cameron Reddish at Duke, who really could, with a great overall year, be number two, number three, number four in this class. And those guys have been very, very underwhelming and have really hurt this class. What's saving this class, Coles Wicker told me this, is, and I agree after really looking into it, is the sophomores. Ja Morant out of Murray State is a guy we'll talk about in a sec. DeAndre Hunter, you'll remember from last year. Jarrett Culver from Texas Tech, you might be familiar with if you were very inside draft Twitter last year. He was a guy that had like first round buzz according to some, and he's come out and just had a terrific year. But it starts and ends with Zion. He is not only the best prospect in this class, but one of the best prospects we've had in quite a while. You watched the Kentucky game, I believe. You've seen your elements of Zion. How would you describe him to someone who's only seen his YouTube highlights and dunk highlights, and why he's such an enticing overall prospect?
I personally see him like Draymond with 40 more pounds and with 6 inches on his vertical and more explosive. That's like, you wrote, you're comparing him to these guys who don't even play basketball. And I think I just see the Draymond thing because he does a little bit of everything. He'll make the right pass. He makes some great passes. He's not a huge assist man right now, but I'm not sure he needs to be because he can just make plays himself, and he's playing at Duke, where we've seen in the past where prospects kind of, it's happening to Reddish right now, where you don't really know what he's doing. Like, Zion's just, you wrote a question mark by his position, but I think,
I have no idea.
But that's why I think, like, that's the best I can do, because I think he's a power forward. Like, I don't care that he's only 6'5", 6'6". I care that he can defend bigs. Obviously, he has length, and his athleticism makes him a better rim protector than you would think for being his height. I think he can actually move laterally like well enough to defend threes, maybe not the best athletes in the NBA. You can tell me if I'm wrong there because you've watched him more, but yeah, I just see this super versatile guy who's gonna make, he has the energy plays, like he's kind of like Josh Jackson, and that's how he profiles to me. So
yeah, that's,
Draymond's the closest thing, and if he gets a jump shot, that's gonna just change everything for him.
Yeah, I think the first place to always start with him is that there are a handful of guys, maybe 36 in the league. That's probably being too generous to some, but it's because the Suns have like 3 or 4 of them where they have dude is everywhere gene, where they'll have a 5-minute stretch where it feels like they made 14 different plays that changed the game. Josh Jackson's like that. Kelly Oubre, as fans are coming to know, is like that. Rashawn Holmes is like that. And Zion is certainly like that. He is everywhere on the court, and you can watch guys and see the quote-unquote competitive fire, as I put my talking head hat on, and intensity and all those types of things. But dude has it, and that's very, very important for him, because his energy plays and all of those types of things are going to be a big part of the player that he is, because he doesn't have a jump shot right now, and him having a jump shot off the dribble would make him maybe one of the 3 or 5 best prospects in the past 25 years. But he's just not there yet. But with that being said, I actually had him at 2 at the start of the season, just because I hadn't really seen him in a... I watch my, like, as much as I can of high school and AAU and all that kind of McDonald's All-American stuff. But at some point, you just need to see them in a college environment, which is still rough, believe me. But just seeing him in that first game and seeing how he can handle the ball and make reads and everything, it's very clear that he's able to transition his athleticism into skill.
So right now, he's shooting 65% overall, averaging 19.8 points per game. He's only taken 18 threes, made 3, so that's very, like, 1.5 per game, and that's 17% shooting. So that's not good. But then you go, obviously he's a good rebounder, 9.4 per game, 2.3 assists, almost 2 blocks, just over 2 steals. So he does a lot. And
I didn't know the steals and blocks were that high. Wow.
Right. So if you're the Suns, you do not need... And that's kind of the thing at this draft. He's not a number one guy. I don't know if he ever will be. But if you have Devin Booker and TJ Warren and DeAndre Ayton already, and he plays power forward like I think he would project, then you're there. I think
he can be a number one guy, but you look at him and say, okay, in the first 3 to 4 years when he figures out his offensive identity and kind of turns into whatever it is, whether it's Draymond Green light or he's some point forward Ben Simmons, kind of Barkley in his Sixers days type of guy, or he's more Barkley in his Suns days where he's more of a scorer from that. But Barkley had the jumper going, and that's something that's going to be interesting for him going forward. But you put him in a situation like the Suns. Another guy we're going to talk about for a second is Jarrett Culver. And what I said with Culver is, I don't know if he can be a first banana, but if you put him next to someone like De'Aaron Fox or Luka Doncic or Devin Booker or any of these guys who are ready to be primary ball handlers, I think he's really special. And the fit with the Suns, if you look at across the league and all the open spots, everyone could use Zion. But with the Suns in particular, with how many of these energy guys they have, how many switchable defenders they have, how much they can run, how much of a high usage primary ball handler they already have, where Zion's not going to be asked to do a ton handling the ball, they're arguably the best fit for him. And that's taking into consideration the defensive and spacing questions you have surrounding him and Ayton. But I just don't think he's a... I'm not worried about his spacing or how he affects spacing or whatever. It's not... I don't think it turns into a situation. I think the main thing to... I think the comparisons we're going to run into when we get earlier into the or later into the year with him, if it's a possibility, is looking at Philly right now, because they've got Embiid and Simmons, and they added Jimmy Butler, and you can see that they're still a long ways away from figuring that out. And you wonder, okay, Simmons ruins the spacing when he's out there. How does Zion figure into this? Well, Booker's just a different offensive player than those guys, and so is Ayton, and I think that is the differentiating factor there. And it would be. I think it would be pretty significant to the Suns' long-term thinking and their overall flight plan going forward to land someone like him at number one in the draft. Because after that, it's kind of rough. Do you have anything else on him? The comparison I had was I like Barkley, Ben Simmons, and Bo Jackson, just because Bo Jackson's, you hear the athlete stories, and I see this dude get a rebound. I'm like, I've never seen anyone grab a rebound like that before.
Yeah.
It's... I don't know how you haven't seen him yet, if you're listening to this and you haven't seen him, but just watch Duke. You'll see him make one of those holy crap plays every 2 or 3 minutes. It's pretty nonstop. Conditioning might be an issue. It was Mike Gribanov of the Stepien is excellent with high school stuff. He said it was an issue for him in high school, and in the Duke games you can see him getting tired from time to time, but 18 years old. He's fine. He's 6'6", 285 and can jump higher and run faster than anyone.
So you have a tier two after Zion of just RJ Barrett, and then you have a tier three of a bunch of guys, Jarrett Culver, Cameron Reddish, DeAndre Hunter, Ja Morant, and Nasir Little, and Kevin Porter, and Bobo. Oh, I see. This goes until 10. But
it does.
Let's say the Suns are two in the draft. Make your case. RJ Barrett, obviously, has his flaws, a bit of a chucker, but I think talent-wise, I agree with you, he's kind of alone. What does he have to do to maybe challenge his teammate and be in consideration for number one?
Zion would have to have like a career-threatening knee injury. I just don't really see it with the way Barrett has played. The number one concern I have with him is that when his chucking is going wrong, he becomes more of a chucker. He's even worse. And you watch Oubre and you're like, man, if this guy could just average 2.5 assists a game, he'd be so much better, because the passes are always there because of the way he drives and he just never sees them. He was actually kind of seeing them with Josh a little bit in the Orlando game, but never sees them. And Barrett's the same way, where you can see him and his footwork and the way he can handle the ball. He's 6'7", he's strong, he has explosiveness, and you just look at him and say, like, you should average like 5 or 6 assists a game in the league with the way you play, and it's just not there. I will say this is one of those things where I worry that it's Duke's system and it's college basketball and it's zone, and once he just gets, maybe we're heading into zone, shout out to the Knicks and Fizdale, but for now we're in man-to-man land. And I think maybe there is where it opens up, But I will say just his what I just mentioned with his footwork and fluidity for his size and the scoring instincts and pedigree that he already has, that's so much significantly better than anyone else in this class below Zion that I think he's the number two guy. What's he averaging on the year right now?
Let me look. But, yeah, I mean, I'm going to... Kevin getting on his high horse about the college game being bad is the spacing is so terrible for these guys. If you just put them in pick and rolls with guys having to guard not at 22 feet, but at 26 feet out, that kind of changes the whole equation as far as making easy reads. And he's not, you know, he's not a bad passer. He's averaging 3.8 per game. He's averaging 24 points, also 6.8 rebounds. But I think that remains to be seen. Like, if you put him in a bunch of ball screen situations, he's going to be able to attack a lot better in the league, I think. So
he's taking 19 shots a game and he's shooting 46.8% from the floor.
Yeah.
And 3-point percentage is at 32%. So that's not terrible. And the assists, I was talking about how much I didn't like it, but he's still averaging 3.8 a game. That's because his usage rate is sky high. It's astronomical.
Fair.
But at the same time, he's averaging 24-7-4 right now. Which is pretty ridiculous. I'd have to look that up for the next big board to see how that compares through a dozen games.
So but. My comp with him is D'Angelo Russell, and yeah, I mean there. You look at the assist numbers. D'Angelo was an assist better than him. Shot a lot better from three, and that's also maybe a concern about his chucking is he's only shooting 32%, but he takes six a game. Like, it's hard to say.
But is he
that bad of a shooter?
Not really. The form isn't so bad. It's just the touch isn't there, perhaps.
Yeah.
And that was the thing with TJ developing his three-point shot, is that his touch was always so excellent on floaters and things like that that it never made sense that he was a bad shooter outside of his form because he has the touch. I'm not sure if Barrett has the touch.
Yeah,
necessarily. But with that being said, if he college to NBA game, if he just dials it back a little bit, and for every two mid-range jumpers or three mid-range jumpers, it's a catch and shoot three, or it's a two dribble pass to someone else, then he becomes a different player because of how skilled he is. And again, to bring this up, an 18-19 year old kid, and an important thing to do is go, if you haven't seen him yet and you're divisive about him and maybe want him on Phoenix, go watch him play for Canada, because that's a different type of game, more space, and where his skills really shine. That's where he was seen as the guy in this class before Zion, and then once we saw Zion in a college basketball game, I was like, oh yeah, this is done. But he's an extremely skilled guy, and the Suns are at a position right now with their roster and where they're at in the rebuild, just take the best available guy.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe trade down one spot or two spots if you can. It makes sense. But in that situation, I think you just have to take the guy and see how it works out. Because he could, I mean, off the bench his first year or two,
yeah,
maybe him and Booker
scoring
play together
pop,
and
yeah,
they can play defense. He's a really, really talented guy. And he's on Duke. So is Zion. So you can watch both of them at the same time. It's been a lot easier for us watching prospects this year.
So this is your big board, which is different than, say, a Suns, you know, Sun specific, but after those two guys, you have Culver, who's kind of a do-it-all guy for Texas Tech. Cam Reddish has really just been like the third wheel, and it's really hard to judge him. DeAndre Hunter, I think if you're looking at Suns specifically, he does a lot of what Kelly Oubre does and Josh Jackson, so I don't know where he would fall. And then you get Ja Morant, who's a point guard. Nasir Little, who is one of the best prospects, and he's hardly played, really.
So he's coming off the bench right now, yeah.
Yeah. Kevin Porter, all these guys. Real quick, though, what do you think the Suns would target, like, based on need and this collection of, like, perimeter players where they already have a couple of swingmen with Mikal and Josh and possibly Oubre if they want to lock him down?
I think you've got to look at this and talk about those freshmen that we discuss, and unless they can certainly change. We're only in non-conference play. It's not even done yet. Conference play coming up, the tournament coming up. Little, Reddish, those guys could have their moments where they fly up boards again. And to be clear here, I think Reddish and Little at like 3 and 4 is the consensus by far. but I'm just lower on those guys right now with where they're at in the season. But I think guys like Culver and Hunter make a lot of sense for what the Suns are doing right now. Yes, it would be yet another wing, but Culver offers a different dynamic as a he's the guy that you just start with Booker in a backcourt, quote unquote, but you have Bridges guard the point guard or the shooting guard, whichever one's the bigger threat. And then Culver is your switchable wing in a three guard backcourt with Bridges, Booker, and Culver, even if one of them is only a guard technically. And then you got Warren and Ayton. I just love what he does because he does a little bit of everything. And the important thing about him, distinctly from last year to this year, is he's become a much better shooter, and he's also grown. He was about 6'3", 6'4", last year, and it looks like he's 6'6", 6'7", now. He's grown a lot and looks to be... has like the broad shoulders where he looks like one of those 6'7", 6'8", bulky wings. So that's how you could use him. And then DeAndre Hunter is more of a... he's a bigger Mikal Bridges. He's more of a guy who can strongly guard threes and fours as opposed to Bridges, who's more 1-3. Hunter actually has a better defensive ceiling, in my opinion, than Bridges. I think he's spectacular. And his shooting has been fine, and his offensive game has developed a little bit. And that's a game to watch, by the way. Duke plays Virginia on January 19th, so we could see Hunter guard Zion and vice versa. That will be a lot of fun, unless the teams play zone and ruin it, which they probably will, because college basketball is the worst.
Tony Bennett won't play a zone, does he? He might. I don't know. Yeah.
But those two guys stand out to me as you're not really complicating things because they fit very specific criteria. Culver's your secondary ball handler. Hunter's your defensive ace on more of bigger players and smaller players. Because the Suns don't have... Mikal Bridges still is not the guy who can guard Kawhi Leonard or guard Kevin Durant. I say guard, challenge them more specifically. If it's a guy a little bit bigger than him or a little bit stronger than him, he's kind of screwed. But Hunter is the guy who fits there better. But with that being said, if you take one of those guys... that's a lot of wing minutes to divvy up. So Ja Morant is the obvious point guard name to talk about briefly. Just watch him. He's Russell Westbrook. Not sure if he can shoot. Not sure if he knows what is a good decision or a bad decision. But he explodes all over the court. He's really, really great with the ball in his hands. His handle's terrific. His vision is really good. I think there's a debate ranking him amongst the best passers in the draft the past couple of years. I think he's just below that Lonzo Ball, Trae Young, Luka Doncic kind of group from the past couple of years. He's pretty great. And the important thing was he's playing for Murray State, which has not been a great place for him to play against high-level competition. But on the 22nd of this month, they played against Auburn, and he was outstanding. Auburn's a top 10 team in the country, and he played really well and showed what he was about. I think he's going to be a top 10 pick in the draft, and I think he could be top 5 if they make a deep run in the tournament. But as far as a fit with Phoenix, like, that's not what you need at all. No. you don't need a guy like him. And I think that's the concerning thing about
point guard, though, Kellen.
That's the concerning thing about looking at this draft. And I'm going to shoot it back to you in terms of your early initial impressions on these guys. Is there anyone that stands out in like the 4 to 7 range? Anyone that's not even on my list that looks, it's kind of like they need like that really smart, savvy power forward, which is Zion to a kind of an extent, or they need that combo guard, defensive ace, D'Anthony Melton on steroids type point guard. It's very specific what they need right now.
This draft class isn't great.
It's not good either. Yeah, that's the bad part.
Yeah, it's just, and fit-wise, it's not good. I think RJ presents some questions if you put him aside Book, but you have to if he's on the board, if they're that high. After Zion, I'm waiting. Like, Bol Bol would not fit. I don't even know if he's going to be a good NBA player. Like, and he's in your top 10. Jonte Porter is coming off a knee injury, and he was arguably a lottery pick last year, but he could have, if he was still in the draft, I think he could have fallen. I don't know. Down to 20 or something, but there's just, someone needs to rise, and I don't know if there will be that guy.
I tweeted Jackson Hoy of the Steppy, and I was like, does Mikal Bridges go number 3 in this draft? If you just take the version of him that was coming out of the draft last year, does like Shai Gilgeous-Alexander go number 3?
Yeah.
I think it's pretty close.
Yeah.
And to the point where you can say yes. Like even Kevin Knox, Colin Sexton.
Yeah.
Just to give perspective here on spots 3 through 7 in the draft, the past 3 years. Last year, of course, Doncic, Jaren Jackson Jr., Trae Young, and Mo Bamba. I think all four of those guys are far superior to anyone you could put at three in this class. Jason Tatum, Josh Jackson, De'Aaron Fox, and Jonathan Isaac from 2017. And of course, 2016 was a bit ugly, but it still had Jaylen Brown, Dragan Bender, Chris Dunn, Buddy Hield, and Jamal Murray. And just that talent gap that drops off there.
Darius Garland was the top point guard in this class. What, a knee injury ended his season?
Ended his year. He's going to be a lottery
guy,
probably.
10, he's 10 on ESPN's big board right now, if I'm looking at the right one. Like, that's where we're at. Lou Dort for ASU is 15 on their big board right now. That's where we're at. And he's has plenty of flaws. If you watch him, great athlete, but plenty of flaws. And he's pushing into lottery territory because he might be one of the three best freshmen in this class. So that's kind of what it is. It's not great.
The dead giveaway of our conversation, I think, was both of us kind of saying if Nasir Little has a great 2 months or if this guy's a great 2 months, they could go number two or number three, and that should tell you the overall.
He's hardly getting like 20 minutes right now per game.
We didn't talk about Cameron Reddish. Over 60% of his shots this year have been from three, and he's not a sharpshooter by any means. The comparison that I made in his draft profile is when DeAndre Ayton was coming into Arizona, we had concerns about his defensive instincts and him settling for the jumper and things like that. So that was important context because we saw those flaws come back and continue. For Reddish, it was just him floating, not impacting games, lacking true consistency on either end. And that's all we've seen at Duke. It's just him be inconsistent. I believe he shot 3 of 20 or 4. He shot a terrible number, and the three teams he played were Hartford, Yale, and Princeton. And I understand it's a really tough place for him to play the third wheel with these guys and figure out what he's doing. But at the same time, he is kind of like the Swiss Army knife prospect. That's what he's supposed to be. So it should have been easier for him to fit into this role, and it doesn't seem like he just knows what he is at all.
Last four games, Hartford, Yale, Princeton, Texas Tech is ranked. His best shooting game has been 33%, 4 of 12 against Yale. He has scored in double digits once over the last four games. He's skinning steals, not much else. These guys are projects.
He's taken 138 shots, and 87 of them are from three. He's shooting 35.6% there, taking only three free throws a game, averaging only 1.7 assists per game. Like, I understand R.J. Barrett's hogging the ball, but at the same time, he should be doing better in this role, and he's only shooting 37% overall.
This is a top five prospect, so.
And this is the guy who's going to go in the top five, probably without a doubt, yeah.
All right.
So I think that's a good breaking off point and to kind of play into why we have been lightly discussing, hey, if you want to trade this pick, put a Zion protection on it and ship it out, maybe put a top two protection on it in case some dude comes out of nowhere or Kevin Porter Jr. looks like the next James Harden or whatever, then okay. But I think shipping a top two or a top three protection on this thing because of the lottery odds and trading it for a point guard or a power forward or anything makes a lot of sense, because we were just trying to figure out who can come in here and help right away, and it's you'd have to wait on Reddish or you'd have to wait on Little or even guys like Culver and Hunter, who I'm excited about. They're still going to take time. Not everyone can be Mikal Bridges and come in here right away. And even Mikal's kind of struggling in some ways. So,
thank you for listening. We hope you had a great holiday season. Hope you have a good New Year's. We'll be back amid this 7-game homestand. When I get done with Cardinals on Monday, I might start hitting the Suns more, so I'll be more informed, like Kellen. But yeah, it's fun right now just to see this team evolve. Thank you for listening, as always. Check us out on iTunes, Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
See you later.